Monday, March 29th, began on an ugly note, with Newsweek greeting us with a story that, in contradiction of the president's expressed hope that Americans would travel in the United States this summer, his two daughters, Linda Bird and Lucy Baines, were planning a grand tour of Europe. Lyndon reacted in a very natural manner. Later in the day, Lucy came to the rescue by releasing to the press her own plans, saying that she phoned her employee, Dr. Robert Kraskin, and said, "Of course I'm not going to Europe. Don't you? You hold on to my job because I'll be there." She said, "This takes the plaid rabbit." I went early over to the East Wing to see the results of the painting up job and the new office for Christine and a little cubbyhole for Simone. "For the first time in 4 years," Christine says, "we are current. All of the boxes and drawers of stuffed away mail have been opened and answered." A little past 12, I went down to the China Room to greet Sir John Gielgud, here for one of the cabinet's culture nights. He's doing The Ages of Man, Shakespeare. He was slight, easy to talk to. I told him how much I'd enjoyed seeing him from the other side of the footlights, and that tonight Linda Bird would be in his audience. And then it was time to greet our first state visitors since we were sworn in, President and Mrs. Maurice Yamayogo of Upper Volta. I met with Lyndon in his office just in the nick of time. We walked out on the south lawn with the flags cracking in the breeze, the military stiff at attention, the uniformed musicians on the balcony of the White House, bugling the arrival of the president's party. Up they drove and out stepped Lloyd Hand to escort the small, bespectacled figure whom the New York Times described as the soft-spoken, tough-minded moderate who believes that the future of Africa lies with the Africans and not with the Chinese or other foreign communists. The day was bright and sunny, and the South Lawn colorful with uniforms, flags, and pomp and circumstance. The ceremony took longer than usual, because after the reviewing of the troops, Lyndon's speech of welcome had to be translated into French, and President Yamayogo's speech in French was translated into English. President Yamayogo spoke without notes, very fluently, but I found myself so interested in looking at the scars on his face, the ritual tribal scars of the Massey tribe, that I rather lost track of the expressions of friendship from his little country of 5 million to ours. Lyndon took President Yamayogo into the bubble-top limousine, and I escorted Mrs. Yamayogo and an interpreter into a following car, and we went on an abbreviated parade through streets amply lined, I'm glad to say, with waving people and decorated with the flags of the two countries. Down ceremonial Pennsylvania Avenue, I pointing out the Capitol, explaining the history of the street. Up 14th to New York and back to Blair House, where with a quick delivery of the key ceremony and a response by President Yamayogo, again without notes, we bid them goodbye. This afternoon, she's to have a steady fare of social service works in this country, a visit to Friendship House, showing how we keep a nursery for working mothers' children, how working people on low incomes, that is, $55 per week or less, can get free legal advice and other services. How strange that must be to someone coming from a country where the annual income is $50. I went upstairs for some desk work, and the unhappy necessity of talking on the phone with Dale Miller about the Look article, which did its best to picture us as a Harding crowd. Dale said he did not discuss one word of his trip to the White House with Texas congressmen and Dallas businessmen with this reporter. But horrifyingly enough, the report of the visit was true enough to make you wonder angrily where they did get it. Dale said, "I guess I just drew the black bean, knew the story they would write beforehand, and they just hung it on to him." For the state dinner, I wore my red dress. Jean-Louis arrived to put my hair up on top of my head. The first hitch is that the guests who were supposed to arrive at 8:05 did not arrive until about 20 minutes past, and I kept running in the yellow room to chat with the Rusk and the G-men in Williams, and back to standard attention to the at the elevator waiting for the call from Blair House. I asked Lyndon how the day had been. He smiled and said, "How would you like to have an old live oak tree for a watch fob?" That's one of those non sequitur jokes that goes back to his childhood, and that not many people besides us would understand. When they arrived, Mrs. Yamayogo was resplendent. In a white gown that was intricately embroidered and tucked and encrusted all over with loopings of beading that shimmered and made a soft whispering sound as she stepped, and a chinchilla wrap around her neck and her ears, on her wrist, on her finger, were red and white stone that may have been diamonds and rubies. I had read somewhere that she purchased some of her clothes from Balmain in Paris. Back upstairs in the East Room, we hastened to pass drinks and have the exchange of gifts. Ours, an Indian drum for the president, and a portrait of the Lincoln family, together with a copy of the Emancipation Proclamation, and one of Lincoln's great quotes engraved on a cigar box. And for Mrs. Yamayoga, silver Indian necklace, handmade, squash blossom design. And to me, one of the most intriguing things, a picture made by Tyrus the Ninth of their country as the satellite flew over it last month. For us, they had gold pins, a delightful chess set, colorful and very African, a red leather saddle with a high back that looks like the Sahara, and a replica of a tribal village, 5 round huts surrounded by a wall. The huts had thatched roofs with tiny figurines of animals and people to complete the scene. The whole can be used as cigarette containers and ashtrays. Downstairs in the line, we rather belatedly received our 121 guests, mostly oriented toward an interest in African-American affairs. Among them, the Theodore Browns, director of the American Negro Leadership Conference on Africa, the John Davises, president of the American Society of African Culture, and the Waldemar Nielsens, the president of the African American Institute. There was, of course, a small brigade from the Senate, the Tom Dodds, always some of my favorites, and the Gail McGees. I hear he has a whole wall filled with pictures of our Western safari last summer, Republican Hugh Scotts and Senator Hiram Fong alone, and the Tom McIntyres. Among the House contingent was Jake Pickle, and with a sprinkling of old friends, Mercedes Douglas Ike Colts and her new husband. Blonde and laughing, she always makes any party go better. And Mrs. Charles Marsh, looking quite dignified and elegant, probably one of the first times she's gotten out since Charles' death. And I was delighted that Diana was there. She was being very busy with her French and her knowledge of Africa from her days with the Peace Corps. And one of her scientists and engineers, Dr. Russell Lee, of Palo Alto, California. The world of science has played an interesting role in the life of Upper Volta. They had been stricken by a scourge of measles some years ago, and a Dr. John Enders had introduced a vaccine that did a great deal to harness and control the epidemic. It was allied with, and somehow, and the Sabin vaccine. I was so pleased that he was there, together with one or two guests from the Merck Laboratories, who had dispensed it throughout Upper Volta. And from the world of arts and letters, there were the Walter Kerrs. I told his wife I had flinched on every page of his book, The Decline of Pleasure. Unhappily, it applied to me at times, and I'd enjoyed her Please Don't Eat the Daisies and longed to see Mary Mary. And there was Herman Wouk, author of Marjorie Morningstar, Mutiny on the Bounty, and more lately, Youngblood Hawk. I was glad to see that some of the guests recognized the name and the man and clustered about him. It must be pretty discouraging to be famous and not to be recognized. And singer Edie Adams, whom we had last seen on the steps of the Capitol, practically, in Austin, Texas, on the night of November the 2nd, the last night of the campaign. She sang for us, as she had many times during the fall. Blonde and cute and gay, she was having a good time all evening. There was a heavy sprinkling of Negroes, naturally, who had made a success in our country, all the way from James Farmer, president of the Congress of Racial Equality, to judges and educators. The line completed, we went in to dinner. I had on my right the president, and on my left the president of the National Assembly. They have a one-house parliament, a congress of 50 members. The going was a little tough conversationally, since I have no French whatever. But the president was articulate and helpful in his own language, and said several things I remember with interest. One, that in the high schools of his country and of several adjoining African countries, Lyndon's speech on voting rights was being read and studied. He's a Roman Catholic in a country where 75% of the population still practices animism. And I discovered that he was very proud that he was the first African chief of state to be received by the Pope. It was the present Pope, not Pope John, whom we had met. He also was proud that they had 9 bishops in his country and 1 cardinal. of the cardinal, he said something like this, that when our red meets their red, that means the current infiltration from the Chinese communists. Our red will disperse them. On the subject of communism in Africa, I asked him how they went about working their way into a country's government, and he said they offered to step in and balance the budget of the country. Once in, they did not balance the budget, and they would not leave. Just before the toast, there was a tense moment when one of the butlers came in with a message on a tray, which he passed to the president. The president opened it, and I'm sure every eye there was trying to read in his face its contents. He then handed it to Secretary Rusk, who read it, folded it, rose, and excused himself from the table, while all sort of gutter-dammerungs went through our mind. And then, great honor to him, Lyndon proceeded with his part of the toast without a flicker of an eyelash. The toasts actually were interminable. 45 minutes because of the translation. I must say I took my hat off to President Yamayoga for being so fluent without any sort of script, and really a nice combination of dignity and graciousness. At last we rose to have coffee in the hall in the red and green rooms, and then on into the East Room for the entertainment, which Maxine Cheshire described as, "They whooped it up at the White House last night with an evening that was as American as the old Buffalo Nickel, when Indian braves in war paint performed tribal dances for the visiting president of the Upper Volta and Mrs. Maurice Yamayoga." There were 35 students from the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. My brother Tony had helped round them up, and they were introduced delightfully enough by a young Indian girl who made a small speech in French. We were a theater in the round, all the guests grouped around a large central stage for this first time that American Indians ever gave a dinner entertainment in the White House. They shuffled and chanted their way through the Buffalo Dance, the Swan Dance, the Apache Mountain Spirit Dance, the Tail Feather Dance, and most interesting of all, the Hoop Dance, in their beads and buckskins and belts and 4-foot-high masts, that being the Apache Mountain Spirit Dance, the most frightening looking of all. Black masks over their faces and only slits for the eyes, and a series of crosses on their heads forming a sort of forest. It's a dance to drive away evil spirits and restore health. The Hoop Dance required the most skill. Only one man dancing agilely around in a whole armful of hoops. First one and then on up till all 18 or so were gyrating around his body. I thought at the time that Theodore Roosevelt had the Japanese wrestlers in the East Room for his entertainment. Thank goodness he set such a precedent. Lyndon had warned Bess that after 20 minutes he was going to get up and make his good night. Thank goodness he stayed for 25 and so had the chance to thank all the Indians. We were really so thrilled to be there. And then another unusual event for a state dinner took place as the President and Mrs. Yamayoga departed with their party. Lyndon accompanied them to the Lincoln Memorial to walk up the steps, stand silently reading the Gettysburg Address, and then as silently turn and leave, while I stayed with the rest of the guests for a little dancing and goodbyes. But that was not the end of the night for him, because the message handed during the dinner had been about a bombing in Saigon right in front of the United States Embassy, in which several Americans and a good many more Vietnamese were killed or seriously wounded. And so after Lincoln came Vietnam, talks with Russ with the Situation Room, a late night. I went on to bed, and it was 3 o'clock when Lyndon came into my room and wearily pulled up the cover.